welcome back. This is the GW Wonkcast. I am your intro person for tonight, Gabriel Moss. I'm here with Natalie Grogan.
Hello.
And our guest tonight is my co-host for the WRGW Sunday afternoon news segment, Robert O'Shaughnessy. I almost said O'Rourke because
O'Rourke?
He's been in my mind.
Oh,
I'm so sorry.
The other Irish guy.
Yeah.
Irishman.
Tall, handsome, good voice. I mean, you got it all.
I wish I was half as good looking as Dano.
It's okay. You got better policy stances than he does.
I have some.
Yeah. So you are here to talk to us tonight about planes, right?
Yes. Specifically the 737 MAX made by Boeing, which are not flying right now.
They are indeed crashing, correct?
Well, two have crashed, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure, yeah. So I'll just get into what the issue is and why they're not flying anymore. A few months ago, an Indonesian airline called Lion Air, Boeing 737 MAX launch partner, crashed off the coast of Indonesia right after taking off. And that didn't get a lot of press coverage because it's an airline that doesn't have a great safety record. And American press was they were very disinterested in it. So we didn't hear a lot about it besides the initial reports. But then a few days ago, an Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 MAX crashed under very similar circumstances, which brought everyone's attention back to the original crash and this recent one. Why did this happen? And are we safe? Because I think a lot of people, normal people who don't care, follow aviation, were familiar with the brand name 737 MAX, i.e. my parents, had heard of it. My dad sent me a video, when they launched it, of, a test flight that they did. So they did a good job of penetrating the normie group of, this is a new product that we're making that's basically, for all intents and purposes, the same as something we've been making since the 60s or 70s, I think, is when the original 737 came out. But basically, the problem is that the MAX, they changed the location of the engines on the wing to make it more fuel efficient. And in the science behind it is basically if they're further up and further forward, it's more likely that the plane will tilt upward. And I'm doing hand motions, but that's totally useless in the audio medium. But the plane is more likely to pull up steep without the pilots wanting that to happen. And Boeing recognized that. So they put software into the plane that would override if they notice the nose rising too dramatically, too quickly, the computer would basically force the nose down.
In a takeoff, when the nose jets up really dramatically and really quickly.
Yes. So there's a sensor in it that basically determines where the nose is relative to where the wind is blowing. It's called the angle of attack. Basically, this system relied on one sensor, one angle of attack sensor. And these planes, I understand, have several of them because you should have multiples in case something fails. And this program, the software that they used, relied on just one sensor. And what's believed to be the problem with both these instances is that the sensors failed and basically sent a command to push the nose down. And the pilots were not trained on that was a thing that could happen, and B, how to quickly solve that problem. It's a really simple problem to fix, and training will alleviate that going forward as long as every pilot is trained properly on how to. It's basically flicking a switch. It's not exactly that, but it's as simple as doing that. But the policy angle of this is that Boeing and the FAA agreed that this wasn't a big enough change to retrain pilots or to teach them, because Boeing wanted all the pilots that already know how to fly the 737 to be able to fly this new plane that they came out with. And the FAA was basically yeah, sure, we don't need to tell people about this. It turns out they did need to tell people about this, because now over 200 people have died as a result of pilots not being aware that this was a...
So nobody had any new training from that change? Or was it up to the airline?
Training wasn't required.
Okay.
Every time a new airplane comes out, pilots have to spend hundreds of hours, like retraining to be certified to fly a type. So if you were, my understanding is if you were trained to fly the 737, you could fly the 737 MAX.
Without any new
training.
And presumably.
Without a new certification, I should say.
That's dangerous.
Which is expensive. Yeah, like certifying a pilot is a crazy expensive endeavor on the part of the airline. So when they heard that they were coming out with this new plane that could go farther and faster and with less fuel without retraining the pilots, bunch of airlines jumped in.
So how many countries are up to now that have pulled 737 MAX? All of them.
There is no country, there's nowhere in the world where you are allowed to fly a 737 MAX.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Well, anywhere that would have it. So like either country that would fly it has banned it or the airline that owns it.
Mm-hmm.
So
you've mentioned the FAA-Boeing connection.
Mm-hmm.
On the way over to record this segment, I was talking to a friend, Raj, shout out if you're listening to this episode, and he was telling me that he had heard that Boeing was allowed to essentially self-certify for this project. Like the FAA delegated to them the safety and protocol certification. Is that accurate?
My understanding is that the Department of Transportation is saying that they are aggressively looking into that. Today, the Secretary Elaine Chao, who I guess I should point out, I work at the DOT as an intern,
okay.
But I don't do any, I push paper, I like,
yeah, this is not your area.
I'm not speaking on behalf of them. If, like, and
I understand.
And I would have no ability to know anything about this. But the Secretary Elaine Chao released a statement that she's directing the Inspector General to investigate what went on here and why was this allowed to happen. Because the media, the public's view of this so far is that the FAA and Boeing have been very chummy. And Boeing was allowed to, like you said, self-test and self-certify, and the FAA would be like, okay, we trust you.
We've been hearing about how the U.S. was late to the decision to ground these planes. Any background as to why?
I think that is also part of the – is why didn't the – well, first of all, the decision to ground the planes was made by the president and not by the FAA, which was – it was unclear at first that if the president was announcing like an FAA when he said we're grounding them, but after the fact it came to fruition that it was his decision and his announcement was basically him telling the FAA these aren't going to fly anymore.
So if he hadn't done that, then they might still be flying if it was up to the FAA.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
He
acted before the FAA did. So it's who knows how long it would have taken them to. They don't have they have an acting administrator right now, and it's actually kind of breaking news today, not to date when this was recorded. I'm not sure, but the president just appointed a former Delta executive.
Okay, and
to be the administrator.
He has a Boeing executive working in the cabinet.
DOD.
Right?
The acting
defense
secretary.
So it's not really directly related, but that is still in his orbit as a Boeing executive.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The U.S. was the last major player to ground the planes. And I think a lot of people might, I know like Liz Warren and other presidential candidates have raised the flag of, is this because of Boeing's potential influence over the government, over the administration, or just the FAA in general, is there something skeevy going on there?
Mm.
And hopefully the OIG investigation will shed light on that. But those probably take a long time, and most people probably won't care by the time that comes out. But the Boeing and the FAA are working on a solution to the problem. And I've been reading stories about how the government shut down, the 35-day-long shutdown that we endured here in D.C. and I guess across the country. Affected that because apparently the Wall Street Journal reported that Boeing was aware of this problem following the initial Lion Air, the Indonesian crash, and they were working on it, but they had to work with the FAA to get things approved and get things launched, which does raise the question of how much self-certifying do they have to do if they're claiming that they had to rely on the FAA to push this update out to the planes. And they said that they were delayed because of the shutdown, because the FAA was one of the agencies that was part of the, that wasn't funded. Of course, air traffic controllers who are FAA employees all went to work, but I guess a lot of people
and
here.
Sometimes maybe they helped to end the shutdown.
A few people, a few in the, what was it?
Gone strike.
Eight people. Yeah, we talked about it on our other show. It was insane.
Yeah.
You shut down LaGuardia,
you
get the government back open.
It was like a handful of people, I think, in Florida and a couple maybe in. Maybe here?
It was D.C.
There was problems in D.C.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was kind of interesting. In the morning, we're saying, shutdown's never going to end.
Yeah.
Never going to end. And,
mm-hmm.
and by the early afternoon, it's over.
Yeah, literally the least solidarity that anyone needed to put together.
No, they should have done that 35 days prior.
Yeah. It's also entirely possible that those eight people were legitimately sick. It's so few people that, like...
It could have just been entirely bad.
Yeah, that's funny. But that's the 737 story, but it's having rippling effects. It's potentially hurting Boeing's name. I read recently Ethiopia, a New York Times piece said that plane and Boeing are interchangeable the way like people say Colgate instead of toothpaste.
Yeah, or Kleenex.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah.
Boeing is so important to the Ethiopian culture because they were exclusively a Boeing airline, and apparently, I guess in Ethiopia, their airline is really important. Culturally to them, at least around the capital.
Interesting.
And now there's talk that this might hurt them. But Boeing,
I'm
going to say Boeing is fine.
Yeah, they're fine.
People
are going to start riding Airbuses? Like, you don't pick your tickets based on what plane.
Another thing to not forget is Boeing's holdings in military.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, that's really the...
Yeah, I mean, their military contracts
are
plenty enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why Boeing stock fell. I was like interested to see like how it would affect it. It fell, but it didn't like it. They were recovered.
It will almost recover entirely.
Yeah, it's like
I'm sure they've had dips, but
yeah,
it'd be like Jack Daniels going out of business. Like it's not gonna happen.
Yeah, it's American.
Yeah,
it's part of America.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking with us about that. All right, so for today, what I have brought to talk about is the recent-ish, back in January, removal of a CFPB regulation from 2017 that effectively capped the amount of usury that payday lenders were allowed to charge for clients. So how payday lending in general works is you come to them, you pay a fee to finance your transaction. Usually the fee is anywhere between 15 to 20% of the amount of money that you're borrowing. Then you give them access to your checking account, and they wait until you get paid. And if the money coming into your account is enough to pay off the balance of your loan plus interest, they will take it out. If it's not, they set up another payday loan. You pay the fee again, and you wait until your next pay cycle.
Okay.
And on average, people that enter this cycle take 7 pay cycles to pay off that initial loan. So it takes you around 2 months to pay off a loan that is, sorry, around 4 months, because it's every 2 weeks, to pay off a loan that was supposed to take 2 weeks.
Is the question, is there interest on that?
Yes, so that the interest is paid in terms of the fees that are charged. So they're supposed to disclose what's called API, which is the annual percentage increase on the loan. Now, a normal like bank API is not going to be that high, right? You're going to be dealing with like, you know, maybe 5%, 10% if it's like a big high interest loan. These are around 400% on average.
Wow.
Because they're structured around a 2-week payoff period. So in order for them to make enough money in 2 weeks to actually give you the money, they need to charge you incredibly high interest rates, because they're based on a 2-week, right? It's like the year's interest, but just for 2 weeks, right? It's
right.
Just if you were to hold it through the year, that's when you'd experience insane amounts of interest, but it's only for a short period. So you're paying like in that period, 10 to 20% of what you borrowed. But the whole system is not set up around you actually paying back your loan like a normal loan. It's set up around those fees to finance. So they actually want you to get locked into this cycle of not being able to pay, and they're happy to keep extending your credit because they can keep charging you that interest fee, right? That fee to borrow. So like $10 to borrow.
Direct access to your account.
They have direct access to your account, which is something that normally is not the case with loans. Normally someone has to sue you to get access.
How do they encourage people to continually have to take out another cycle of the loan?
So they can, I mean, you owe them the money. So if you don't have the money to pay them, they can sell you to a debt collector. The debt collector can come and take you to court and you can get arrested.
Right.
So there's a direct legal incentive. There's a financial incentive where until they're paid off, they can still keep taking every dollar that comes into your account because they have full access to your credit account, or sorry, your checking account. So they see all your income coming in. There's also usually no income requirements, no ability to pay requirements, no thing that says you have to do any like due diligence on this person when you're processing the loan payment. Where a normal bank will do a lot of underwriting and will make sure that you have an ability to pay. So what this Obama-era regulation did was it said you need to make sure someone has ability to pay. You need some sort of control. You need some sort of cap on usury so that we're not seeing people just get locked into these spirals. And critics of that said, well, you're capping people's access to credit because the people that come for these loans don't have any repayability, right? They're not in a situation where they can apply for a regular loan. These are people that don't have $400 to put a tire on their car, right? They don't have $1,000 to pay their kid's medical bill when they fall off a swing and break their arm. So the argument here is over whether or not we should, for the good of a person's future financial health, prevent them from buying an instrument that will directly harm them, or we should make these instruments widely available without regulation so that people can have maximum access to credit, whether or not having access to that credit is directly harmful. So that's kind of the major conversation here. Mick Mulvaney has erred very heavily on the side of just in general, CFPB is not doing something that is necessary. And this is part of his regulation scheme, is removing regulation from payday lenders.
Mick Mulvaney is the head of the CFPB.
Currently.
As well as being the chief of staff.
I don't know, is he still chief of staff?
Yeah, he's acting chief of staff, which just started breaking today that maybe he's going to be changed to permanent. But.
Oh, really? Okay.
He's also acting head of CFPB. Yeah. So he's not, you know, like he's, was it him that his big thing was changing the name of the organization?
I believe that was him, yes.
Yeah, so that was just a tactic to get them to just do something else other than their job so that they wouldn't be regulating, right? Because it takes a long time to like change all the stationery and change all the letterhead and all the emails and all the files and everything. It's just like, it's busy work for busy work's sake. But this is an actual policy stance that he took. And, you know, you could go back and forth on like whether or not this was even effective because it was implemented late into 2017. And it lasted until January of 2019.
Yeah, it seems like there's not a whole lot of opportunity to see how it was implemented.
Exactly.
There's been research to see
exactly
what the effect was.
And to be fair to the payday lenders and the people who support them, there are an incredible amount of people that don't have access to credit and who need money, right? So half of Americans can't scrape together $400. If an emergency happens, they don't have $400 in a savings account or in cash, or in some sort of liquid money. Most of them will be able to pull it from friends and family, or will be able to take out credit card balance that they'll pay off over the next couple months. So they'll go in debt in a more safe way, right? Either debt that has no interest, like a friend, or debt that has a reasonable rate of interest. I mean, credit cards are still high interest rates, but they're not 400%.
Yeah.
But there is around a quarter of those people that will not have access to those. Either their credit cards are already maxed, they don't have any friends or family that have income that they can spare on them, right? If they're also in the situation of not having $400 to spare, right? You can imagine a whole community that doesn't have enough money to support itself in a time of crisis. They will turn to payday lenders because there's no other option, because banks have pretty much been regulated out of this space by CRA, which is the Community Reinvestment Act. And it's this network of regulation that makes sure that banks are investing responsibly in communities in which they operate. Now, part of that is saying we won't do advance loans. So we won't take your, right, banks can used to be able to, and there are a couple that still do, basically do payday loans, but at a much more structured and slow pace. So they see every month how much money is coming into your account. They'd be able to say, oh, we know you have the ability to pay because we're looking at your entire credit history. We'll set up a loan that you can do. And it kind of makes more sense for a bank to be doing this. I mean, obviously, if you're unbanked, then this doesn't work for you. But, you know, a bank is large enough, it has enough information where it should be able to responsibly be able to participate in this. But the regulators that are part of CRA really don't want banks working in this space, so they have pretty much regulated them out, which has made room for all these non-bank entities to spring up. And there's a statistic in the same study that found the half of Americans not able to spend $400 that says that there's more payday lenders, like more shops in the United States than Starbucks and McDonald's franchises put together.
Wow.
No.
No way.
Yes.
That's insane.
Yes.
Wow.
That's
a
lot.
It's a nuts statistic. I haven't verified this for myself, but this is from a federal level regulator. So it is reputable enough, right? And it you go to places where, I mean, we're in the Northeast, well, Mideast.
Yeah.
It's not very common here. I mean, if you drive up to Maryland, you start to see them right on the border of D.C., but D.C. itself has some pretty serious regulations on them. You know, we have Western Unions, but I don't really know what our usury caps are for payday lenders. There are several states that don't allow them outright.
Yeah.
They're much more popular elsewhere in the country. So in other areas, you see them much more. In low-income areas, you see them much more.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to New York City, if you go to, like, Brooklyn, they're all over the place in Brooklyn to some extent, you know.
What was the situation prior to the 2017 regulation?
So it was basically the situation that we're in now, where they're pretty unregulated.
Okay.
I mean, they've been steadily growing. The issue is really around what we think consumer protection needs to be. I mean, obviously, the Bureau named after protecting consumers has some sort of nominal, to, you know, make a pun, interest in doing this sort of protection. But I would argue, and I don't think it's a very controversial standpoint, that these organizations are pretty abusive in how they're structured. You know, they're designed to prey on people that do not have resources that are forced to turn to them, and they're basically able to set the standards for that exchange. Like, it's not a fair market in terms of equal partners agreeing on an exchange. You know, it's not the same as going to, like, Macy's and buying a hat, where you and Macy's have relatively equal power in that dynamic. You can either walk away. No one can walk away from the, if you're needing to go into the payday lender, you can't walk away. And then once you agree, you literally cannot run away because they have complete access to your finances. And once they're done with your finances, either you've paid off all your debt or they've sold you to someone whose then job it is to bring you to court and sell you to a sheriff's office, whose job it is to sell you to a private prison.
I feel like the big problem here, I've known about this for however long, like 5-10 minutes. After learning about this for 5-10 minutes, I feel like the problem is the direct access to the bank account.
It's pretty
I'm
alarming.
I'm surprised
isn't
that
it?
That's
yeah,
not the thing that's
well,
big. Because, like, the rates that they're charging feel like more like they're taking on a lot of risk. If
mm-hmm.
they're so, like, their interest rate would have to. You should be expected to reflect that. But the direct access to the bank account seems like that would be what should be regulated.
So that's actually a fairly common phenomenon now. Like, if you use Lyft, Lyft has direct access to your bank account.
Oh, I don't like that.
Yeah, a friend of
Venmo
mine.
Does.
Yeah, Venmo
does.
Yeah, Venmo
does. Venmo does.
A friend of mine, she went in a Lyft ride. It ended. And then the Lyft driver charged her $5,000 for ruining his car. She didn't. He was trying to get money out of her, but Lyft withdrew $5,000 from her checking account.
Wow.
She was then able to appeal that decision, become part of a class action lawsuit, I believe through the CFPB. I think that was where she wound up submitting her complaint. It might have been through the Fed. I don't remember exactly what window she went through, but she went to the federal government and submitted her claim. She was part of a bunch of other people that had similar things done, and she got her money refunded to her. So this is a fairly common digital age phenomenon where we have agreed that this is okay. And I think in most situations, it's an acceptable thing, right? If, you know, Lyft, for instance, it's a company. You can sue the company. It needs to have direct documentation. But the payday lending is literally set up around sapping money out of your account without your, I mean, you've given consent, but without your direct participation until you've either paid back your loan or you have no more ability to pay. And they argue that it's essential to the model, and I would say that it is essential to their model, in that they're not underwriting you. They have no idea your likelihood to repay or your credit history, and they all they have is that you have a bank account. So you need to show pay stub, that it goes to your bank account, they need to see your bank account, charge your bank account, your fee for processing your first loan, and then they're off to the races.
This seems to me a little bit of a slight comparison with student loans. Bear with me. So student tuition didn't used to be, shocking to all of us, the tuition did not used to be as high as it is today.
People didn't used to pay $60,000 for grad school?
No, they did not. And part of this change was student loan companies used to be able to restrict how much they could approve for somebody based on their ability to pay, which significantly limited who could take out these loans. And so in the interest of wanting more people to have access to higher education, that was eliminated. And so then they could charge a lot of money, much more money for tuition than had previously been charged by the universities. And the universities are getting paid no matter what. So it's kind of right, when it comes to credit and student loans, more people are having access to credit / student loans, but they don't have any ability to pay it off. And so if a company is loaning money, they want to get the money back. That's what their business model is. Well, they need to make a profit.
But not, this is the really twisted part. Their business model isn't about getting paid back.
Yeah, right. That's what struck me.
Their business model is about the fee. So it's actually, I mean, the comparison to student loans, I think, is good. I think the really solid one is to sharecropping. So it's essentially the same system as sharecropping, just sped up, right? Sharecropping is based on a year calendar as opposed to a two-week calendar. But in sharecropping, you go to the general store / bank, and you take out a quote-unquote loan where they give you your seeds, your tractor, your plow, what, you know, the items you need to plant your harvest and reap your harvest, with the understanding that in the fall, when you harvest, you'll come back to them and pay off your loan with the produce that you have made in the year. The system is designed so that you never make enough during the year to pay off and then have enough money to outright buy the supplies you need for the next year. So the next year, you again need to borrow. So they're subsisting off this payment every year to just get the initial stuff with the borrowed rollover from the next year. And you essentially roll into debt peonage, where everyone in the system is rolling on debt, and the only money being generated is the transaction cost of actually processing the debt payment. So for this, it's happening just on a much more accelerated scale. And the part I find really bizarre about it is they don't make that much money.
I was going to ask how profitable this was.
It's like okay profitable, but it's not, you know, it's not, we're not talking
about...
It's
not student loan profitable.
It's not student loan profitable. It's not ExxonMobil. It's not, you know, this huge industry. It's big. It's not numerically big because there's so much lack of access to credit. People need money because things are so expensive and wages are so low. But there is not a definite payoff beyond what you'd get, you know, running, an outsourcing business or a call center, you know, like any sort of secondary industry, right? I don't think it would compare to, it's probably better than running a shop. You know, it's probably better than...
It's better than McDonald's.
It's better than McDonald's. But because it's a storefront, like they're all storefronts. I mean, there are online ones, but most of them are physical storefronts in a metropolitan area. That cost is actually pretty high, and the hourly cost of your workers is pretty high. So you're reliant on that 400, 500% usury to actually pay off those costs, and really you don't make that much money. So no one's like, the really sick part I find is no one's directly really, really, really benefiting. I mean, people are benefiting and people are losing out, but it's kind of just this bad solution to the overall problem of complete lack of access to credit in the country, right? Like the fact that half the country can't put together $400 is a fundamental flaw with our economic system as it stands right now, right? That's really unhealthy. That's really bad because, I mean, we just saw what happened in the Midwest with the flooding.
Right.
Right?
Emergencies happen. Then.
Emergencies happen, and they're completely out of your control. And the science on it is they're going to keep happening, right? Period. That's it, right? Like, world tends towards chaos. It's going to happen. So you're never going to be able to put off those costs. And if half the country can't afford a $400 cost, well, that's bad. That's really, really bad. We need to start talking about that. And, you know, these payday lenders aren't part of a solution. They're just addressing a problem and creating another problem. You know, it's not constructive. It's just almost parasitic. That's my take on it, my hot take.
No, it's very interesting, and it seems like there's, like you said, there's really no good solution for this because emergencies do happen. People do need credit.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, a high-risk kind of loan like that necessitates high interest rates, but it doesn't necessitate the predatory practices inherent.
So there's some people at Pew right now. Their policy recommendation has been for the last little bit, well, let's start incentivizing banks to operate in this space once again. And let's subsidize their cost of financing these risky loans to some degree, right? Let's help them facilitate these loans. I mean, at this point, it's kind of silly to say the cost is underwriting. It's not. Underwriting is painless and free. Essentially, you just need a good data package, right? I mean, that costs money, but the fact that Quicken can do underwriting in like 5 seconds, like I recommend you to try applying for Quicken and stuff. It's kind of fun to like see just how quickly they can underwrite you. But they pull your credit, they pull your payment history, they check your, you know, where you've lived and your outstanding debts, and they process a loan payment for you. So
why doesn't the government do that for background checks?
I think because background checks are a lot more complex.
Okay.
Right? Like
I recently had to fill out like residency
mm-hmm.
history, and it is a pain in the butt if you
yeah.
are a student, like for the past 5 years.
Oh,
going
God,
back and
yeah.
working all around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I was like, oh my, but
yeah,
you're
so,
telling me it can be done in 5 seconds?
Well, I mean, underwriting alone is a much different process than getting
yeah.
a security clearance.
Okay.
Right, all they need to know is how much money does this person reliably bring in? How much money do they reliably spend? How much are they in debt? Where have they lived that might contribute to this? Maybe family credit history if they're being really litigious, but they don't need to be for this sort of thing. So the idea is help banks move into this space, open up the regulations on banks to encourage them to be in this space. Now, I'm kind of skeptical as to the degree that that will work because I don't know if we've talked about it on this podcast before, but it would be really interesting to talk about the lack of bank access, right?
I don't think we have. Maybe we should.
So there's a huge segment of the population that has no access to banks because they just don't exist in their community. And it's not like, you know, you can apply for a bank, you know, like an online account at a bank, but it really, for most people, it's really hard to do that, right? If, you know, a lot of the country doesn't have access to broadband, they're probably not going to have access to online banking,
right?
So it's the sort of thing where really, you know, this needs to be part of a wider approach to access to credit, right? We need to say, okay, let's change how we do short-term lending, but let's also talk about the fundamental fact that people don't have credit. They don't have banks. They don't have incomes that can supply credit in any meaningful capacity.
Right. I mean, there's always a question of when you're taking out a loan, you are promising to pay it back. And if somebody is going to underwrite that,
mm-hmm.
they need to have some kind of guarantee that you're going to pay it back.
Exactly.
Which is hard if you don't have that ability in the first place, because that's why
yeah.
you needed the money.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, is that the private business's responsibility to loan you money that you can't pay back?
Yeah.
It seems like a vicious cycle.
Exactly, yeah. So it's an interesting and thorny question on how to actually solve it. All right, so finally, today we've got Natalie. You've brought in something about a court.
So recently the previously radical idea of adding new justices to the Supreme Court / new justices to federal benches has gained more political traction, especially among the presidential candidates for the Democratic nomination.
Oh.
Specifically, I mean, I think now at this point, a lot of them have endorsed either the idea or debate on the idea, such as Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, and Kamala Harris.
Adding like a 10th and 11th seat?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, interestingly enough, the number of justices in the Supreme Court is not listed in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And the number has changed in the past.
Yeah.
But it has been pretty steadily 9 for...
Like a long time, right?
Several decades at this point. More than 50 years at this point. And the last time this was really floated was actually by FDR. In the 30s, President Roosevelt tried to add more justices to the Supreme Court, which became known as the court packing scandal because it was...
He wanted 23?
Yeah, he wanted a ton more justices to the Supreme Court. And both Democrats and Republicans, and even FDR's own vice president, said that this was a really bad idea, that it was nakedly partisan, and that it was not permissible.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that scandal, it's kind of been a fringe,
mm-hmm.
a fringe idea, but now it's been brought up again. Part of that is because the Democratic candidates feel that the court has become political, has become partisan.
Which I think, given the Senate's actions over the last couple of years, is pretty fair, right? Like with the Garland stuff into Kavanaugh, like it was clearly those were drawn along party lines on both sides, what people were saying.
Yeah, and it seems like both parties have pulled punches when dealing with the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
They've both done away with norms when they wanted something and the other side wasn't giving them what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much that one party is trying to pull one over on the other. It's that kind of both parties are trying to pull one over on each other.
Yeah,
because they don't like what the other one is doing, but then they do the same thing when they're in power. And for those who don't know, we're talking about instances such as doing away with the filibuster
mm-hmm.
when dealing with Supreme Court nominees.
Yeah.
You used to have to get a supermajority in the Senate to approve a Supreme Court nominee, and now you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because people were just blankly opposing all judicial nominees from a president they didn't like. And so then, shockingly, the Senate turned to a different majority, and then suddenly the rules were different.
Mm-hmm.
So they changed the rules again, and it's not... I don't think that it's gotten to the point where the Supreme Court is lost as an institution that is too politicized.
Mm-hmm.
But it's being politicized in ways that are detrimental to its future. And that's what these candidates are discussing. Adding
mm-hmm.
more seats to make it better for partisan, to make it more bipartisan. Now, there's a lot of disagreement as to what the wisdom of a move like this.
Yeah.
I think we should definitely have a discussion on the merits of this idea, because it affects the third co-equal branches of government.
Yeah.
But personally, I see this prospect as pretty partisan, because
I am very
there's
doubtful.
Obviously a reason that it's only Democrats who want to do it, because
they're in it's. The, right,
it's
swung
position.
Right, and so they're saying, hey, we can add seats. And, you know, if their rhetoric is true and they want to add nonpartisan judges, okay.
What does that mean, though?
Whatever. Yeah, and it's like, well, when the next guy gets in and appoints someone else, like, it's not the seat isn't called nonpartisan, right? So this is a problem I have with the Supreme Court in general, is just the lifetime appointment seats. And I understand the logic of it, and I see why it was done. But I do believe it trends towards something like this, where you have really politicized courts, not because of the judges themselves, but because of just the president can really leave their mark if a couple deaths line up at the right time, right? They can really swing 20 to 50 years worth of policy if things get in the right shuffle. And I find that to be a problem. So less, I mean, like, I like the idea of a large high court, not because of necessarily like it'll solve this politicization, but just because I think it'll be more voices, and I think more judicial opinions on something is a good idea.
Right.
So I think that they're not a terribly efficient institution right now, right? They hear like 3-5 cases a year. Like it's not a very packed bench worth of stuff to do, but you know, I think more judges wouldn't necessarily harm the process.
It just seems like if you want to add more judges because you don't like the makeup of the court now, then that'll switch the makeup of the court, and then suddenly different people want to add more justices to the court,
it
goes back and forth and back and forth. And it's not like there's never been an instance before when the court swung to one direction. That's always...
It's always how it's been.
It's a nine-person court. I mean, it's not an even number. There's going to be a majority.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. That's how you make a decision on it. And it just seems like this could start a never-ending battle for decreasing our judicial norms.
I like it as a principle on its own, siloed. Like, I like a bigger court in general. I just, more opinions, I think, is a better idea than fewer opinions. I don't think it, I am absolutely on your side. Like, it's a completely asinine decision for fixing the problem, right? The problem isn't that there's too few judges of the ones that I like. The problem is judges are appointed for life, and the appointment method is not nearly involved enough, right? Like, solidify how they're appointed, make rules around that, or change their term limits, make rules around that. Like, don't, I mean, those require constitutional amendments, so the president can't do them, but.
I think this puts another spotlight on a problem that I've been noticed since coming to GW, is that the Constitution was written in such a, or yeah, it was written in such a different time.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't reflect, this was written in a time, perhaps, when people didn't live nearly as long, and
mm-hmm.
the idea of a lifetime appointment means something very different in 2019 than it did when the Constitution was written.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, that's my opinion, is that it's worth looking at.
Talking about, like, I mean, like, the structure itself might be okay, but the law was written before the Industrial Revolution, right? We have had a complete worldwide economic overhaul. Everything has changed since the time when the Constitution was written, which could be good, it could be bad, but it is reason to be inquisitive as to the logic behind certain choices. And I think that there is something to be said for the Supreme Court was designed for a country of 13 states with, I don't even know how many millions of people, but less than 300 million people.
Yes.
Right. Same with the Senate, right? Like the Senate.
And a bunch of slaves.
And a bunch of slaves. Yeah.
It's a
justice system built on a completely different system of ethics.
I'm just saying it's something that should be looked into. That should be, I think, discussed more than it is.
I'm personally not surprised to hear that Booker and Harris and Gillibrand are in support of court packing, or at least expanding the court.
Right.
That seems to me in line with their policy stances on a lot of stuff.
It seems funny that we've never really talked about this until this week. It was
mm-hmm.
not in the news at all. This week.
It's put forward, like you said, as a cautionary tale against despotic presidents, right? It is
something
that was
stopped.
To be honest, I was kind of expecting Trump to. What I thought back in November was Kavanaugh was not going to get approved, and then Trump was going to throw like four names out there and say, "I'm packing the court." I thought that was going to happen. I was kind of excited for it because I was like, ooh, constitutional crisis. This might be kind of fun. But it didn't happen. It didn't go that way. He got what he wanted and backed down. So I'm kind of, I mean, it makes sense that it's the Democrats that are bringing it forward as opposed to Trump going into 2020.
Right.
I am interested to hear how the rest of the field responds to it. I mean, you know, does Warren pick this up? Does, you know, Bernie pick this up? Where does this land on more disparate doorsteps than the kind of centrist trio.
At this point, it's an intellectual exercise
because
there's majority in the Senate does not support this, so it's moot at this point. But that could change. But it seems more of a play to get elected.
Yeah, it's definitely it feels.
But I think we should have a conversation about the Supreme Court and its politicization.
Certainly.
Because that's not what it was intended to be. And as somebody
no.
who really wants the Constitution's principles to transcend that time period,
mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that you can never have a discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
And since the court was not meant to be a political institution, the fact that it has become on the verge of becoming almost nakedly partisan
mm-hmm.
is dangerous. That's not really what it.
Yeah,
that's not at all what it was intended to be.
Yeah, I mean,
and even though the Constitution was written before the Industrial Revolution, I don't think that the principles that the Constitution was written to support
mm-hmm.
changed during the Industrial Revolution.
That's definitely fair.
It was built on principle. It was written for principles and not for geographic expansion
mm-hmm.
and a higher population. And those can change. I mean, the Constitution has been changed before, but it's also this, the number isn't in the Constitution.
Yeah.
I think it started at 5.
Yeah. They should have specified a number.
It used to be an even number. And
I think that, that's definitely like a good point to talk about how this has diverged from the idea of the Supreme Court. I mean, we've had for a long time now the ability to elect judges in many states. I think that this is an imperfect option as well, as then the judge becomes influenced by the political milieu, so to speak.
Right, and that can cause its own set of problems.
Exactly. I mean, that's right. Like kangaroo courts, right? That's the whole issue with that. So I think that you have... That's not a good option, right? Like, voting for judges is not good. You do need some sort of Senate or maybe House involvement. But I think clearly, like, the politicization of the Senate and the complete abandonment of Senate norms from both parties over the last 10 years has really harmed the institutions directly, directly influenced by the Senate. So as, you know, appointees to head different organizations or different, organs of government, and the Supreme Court, most importantly. I don't think it's inherently like a problem with the court itself or any one judge on the court. More, it's a spillover effect from the Senate's spiral.
Right, because it seems like the Senate has changed the role that it plays in confirming Supreme Court nominees. Yes, and it seems to be that in order to vote for a judicial nominee, you have to agree with their judicial philosophy instead of thinking that they're qualified.
Yeah.
Because the president does have the ability, the authority to nominate justices, and it shouldn't shock anybody that when a conservative president appoints conservative justices, that's what happens. Elections have consequences. But it doesn't, if I was senator, it wouldn't really matter whether I agreed with what they would rule on, whether they were qualified and were able to discharge the functions of that office is what's important, because I wasn't elected president. I was elected senator to approve of them, to make sure that they weren't somebody who had no knowledge of the law, but could make that decision. And it's not like justices have never changed their minds. It's sometimes ironic. Sometimes what justices become swing votes that were supposed to be reliable conservative or reliable liberal, and they change sides. I mean, that's not something that can be guaranteed. But the Senate has, both parties have kind of abrogated their responsibility to the process in terms of opposing or supporting any nominee that they have to support because of politics.
I mean, there's now a whole industry of judge preparation, right? There's a whole industry around creating rosters of basically fantasy football teams of judges to run through these politicized processes. And it's clear that, you know, I would say the lion's share of senators, they're not voting out of any sort of personal belief about the person. They're voting on party lines. They're voting because, or like, either because this organization says yes or because they hate the organization that said yes.
Right.
Like, that's determining their opinion on the matter, not the actual judge. And it's clear the president isn't choosing judges based on the president's opinion of the judges. It's the pipeline that has brought the judge.
The think tanks tell them.
Exactly, which is super problematic, because that's, again, violating the understanding in the Constitution that the president will pick the person that they feel will best suit the job. Right.
And the job is to uphold the Constitution and provide a check on the other two branches of government.
And
you're kind of appointing somebody who's not going to provide a check on you.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't benefit you, but that is literally what the job is to provide a check
on your
legislation that
yeah.
was passed and signed.
I think at the end of the day, the only way is to hope that they're good actors. And whoever, the people on the Supreme Court, I've been putting in my head, like, how do we get people on the court who aren't beholden to a party or to
people?
You just
gotta roll the dice.
And I think, like, a lot of the older people on the court now, like, Roberts has shown that he's not really, he's willing to look outside of party. Like, I think on the same day, he said he approved like an important part of Obamacare, and then the same day he said gay marriage isn't a constitutional right.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two like very different ideological, like one is a
right.
really conservative standpoint,
mm-hmm.
and one is like a more liberal standpoint. And he's one guy, so I guess you just have to hope that they're good actors.
I think
I
that oftentimes the way that we discuss the Supreme Court, that the three of us have been discussing it the whole time too, is what it means to be conservative and liberal is
mm-hmm.
not really the same as what it should mean in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
In that the Supreme Court should be what is constitutional.
Yeah.
And there can be things that are both left-wing politically and right-wing politically that could either be constitutional or unconstitutional. It depends on what it is.
Yeah,
and
on
should...
your definition of constitutional, right? If you're a strict
right.
constitutionalist, or you're more of a liberal constitutionalist, but not like left-leaning. But,
if it's
you know,
a living document
exactly,
instead
yeah.
of set in stone, doesn't
yeah.
change. And so that to me is what is most important when determining who the justices
mm-hmm.
are, because you could have a justice that thinks that the Constitution is a living, breathing document, but yet would fall into a conservative political party
mm-hmm.
because those don't line up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that we use the court is that to achieve specific policy objectives.
It was basically to do violence on the other party, right? That's like
right,
kind of
which is
it's
not
seen
the point.
As this weapon
right.
to exact your view of the world in a punitive measure by striking down the actions of the other group. Like it's not even constructive. It's always viewed as like we're going to use it to do this. And it's very, very much instrumented, which is frustrating. Thanks for coming in, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
It was awesome. Yeah.
And thanks for bringing that in, Natalie. Thanks for bringing in the Boeing story.
Sure thing.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Robert and I are on every weekend, WRGW.
Sundays at noon.
Sundays at noon. You can go on iHeartRadio and yeah. look up WRGW.
Yeah.
And
check
we'll
us out.
There. Yeah, with our co-host, Olivia. So if Olivia's listening for some reason, hi, Olivia.
Hi.
Made it through.
Wherever you listen to your podcast, be sure to subscribe to GW Wantcast. Maybe rate us, leave us a review.
Mm-hmm.
We're on Facebook as well. And
Instagram
and
Twitter. Yeah,
yes.
So, you know, interact with us.
Their Instagram account is fire. I follow it. There's
yeah.
some good, there are gems in there.
Yeah, Henrietta the Hippo does make quite a few appearances.
Thanks for listening. See
Thank
you,
you
next time.